Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 400 CTOs who share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insights into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, please visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. Thanks a lot to our sponsor, The About You Cloud. The About You Cloud offers a full-stack e-commerce solution as a service that runs on exactly the same infrastructure as the About You Shop does. It is mobile-first, can act as headless system, event-driven, can be fully localized, and is super integrated into existing solutions. Besides that, it is designed and developed by a really smart CTO and friend of mine, Sebastian Betz. About You has set up a task force for retailers and brands that want to be quick in the COVID situation. This task force will help you with the launch of your shop, as well as with fulfillment, marketing, support, and internationalization. Simply write to hello@aboutyou.com to be supported by this task force. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby, and my guest today is Jean-Denis, the CTO of Plaid. Plaid is considered a unicorn in the fintech space, collected around $300 million in funding and just turned down an acquisition by Visa. Was that all correct, Jean-Denis?
It's all correct. Thanks for having me, Toby.
Your name doesn't sound as if you work for a unicorn in the fintech space in America, but rather a bistro in Paris. Are you from France?
I am from France. My parents are both French. My mom actually is from Paris and my father is from the Auvergne region, which is in kind of central France. But I was born in Switzerland and I grew up there until I was 11. And then my dad was working for a U.S. corporation, so we moved to the U.S. I'm pretty well Americanized by now, so all my family members still live in France and they call me the American. And if you're a French person and you call someone the American, it's not a compliment. So I'm a little bit of the black sheep of the family, if you will.
I guess so, but I hope you can still speak French.
I can still speak French. I speak French well enough, but a little bit like an 11-year-old would speak French. So I don't speak about technical things or business in French. By the way, you said I wish I were in a bistro in Paris, but you know, bistros in Paris right now are not exactly open. I will say Silicon Valley is fascinating. There are so many Europeans here. You can live in San Francisco and feel like you're surrounded by French people all the time if you want to. So the diaspora lives.
You initially worked as a lawyer and now went the CTO track. Is that correct?
I studied computer science in university and actually worked in tech during the first internet bubble and for a few years after that was kind of a grad student in CS. And then I did this thing in my mid-20s where I changed career path, studied law and worked as a lawyer for a year before deciding that wasn't really for me for a variety of reasons. We can go into it if you want. And ended up going back into technology first, kind of doing engineering for companies in the hedge fund and banking space, and then eventually moving to Silicon Valley, working at Dropbox and then at Splat. And, you know, initially when I went back into tech, I was an individual contributor. I was an engineer. But at some point I kind of fell in love with management and that took me more towards the head of engineering and CTO track.
And now you're jumping on the second bubble.
I mean, look, the history of capitalism is a history of bubbles. Right. You know, the question is, how big do they get before they pop? It does in the past, for sure, like 3 to 6 months, just everything feels a little crazy to me. But whether that's a tech bubble or, you know, government funding from COVID or whatnot, I'm not in the know about what's happening. I will say right now feels like much less of a bubble still than the initial bubble in the late 2000s. It was insane. I mean, the first company that I worked at out of college, the founders had, one of them had been a partner at a law firm. The other one had been a partner at McKinsey, which is a really big consulting company. There are people with almost no no technical background or expertise. People were leaving careers that they had spent 15, 20 years building, like very, very successful people, just because like the thing that had to be done was, you know, build a tech startup with no business plan, no revenue plan, no anything. And actually not that even that many people on the internet. I mean, it was not just like the speculative aspect of it. It was just like a bending of reality. I mean, I think right now you could say the valuations of companies in tech are too high, right? You could make those arguments, but at the end of the day, people are trying to build businesses. There are billions of users, value is being delivered. So yeah, it feels bubbly, but it doesn't feel as insane as the first one did.
One fundamental piece in the puzzle is also that there's no alternative. And like, if you want to invest your money right now, the stock market is the only chance, right? And that in a way also drives values.
That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry for the bad question at the beginning.
No, it's a great question. I just, you know, I'm like in the middle of it, right? So I have mixed feelings about it. Like, it worries me, right? Because it's like the ante and how much you have to deliver and how much growth you have to provide keeps more pressure on it. But I think I look at it, and at the end of the day, be it Plaid or a lot of other companies, I think they're really sound businesses, like long term.
Okay. I think for the people in Europe, you have to explain Plaid a bit.
Of course. So in Europe, you have something called open banking, which is, I think, implemented to a varying degree, maybe of goodness by different banks or different players. But it effectively means that if your core bank is A, and you want to use an app that relies on some of the data that bank has, there's a mechanism for you to share data from one bank to another. It's like very high level, kind of the principle behind open banking. In America, that doesn't exist. There are no laws around open banking that make it easy for consumers to move money around or share their data from one app to another. And, you know, if you step back, you look at it, like the regulatory landscape in the United States is very different. Like, the United States believes strongly in like market solutions. So in the United States, as opposed to a law being passed, basically these companies such as Plaid exist. And Plaid's job is to make it easy for fintech apps to be used by consumers, because we allow the app to connect to their core bank account to help the app make a loan or help a user move money around. There's, you know, something called Square Cash or Venmo that allow people to transfer money, like basically for free from one person to the other instantly, or apps that allow people to save for retirement or manage their expenses or get financial advice. And there are 10,000 banks in the US. It's a very, very diffuse banking system. And so there has to be a company that has integrated with all 10,000 banks on one side that then allows these apps to exist without each app having to build 10,000 integrations, right? Because that's a huge cost. That's what Plaid is. We're like a very simple API, like a standard API on top of the financial system for apps to build, you know, customer experiences on top of.
Are you a bank yourself or?
No, we're not a bank. We don't actually touch the money. We just allow you to share the data, right? So if you're a lender, right, you need to then make a loan on top of the data that we send. If you're going to move money around, we give you information just as the bank account number, the routing number, balance info, fraud signal that tells you we think whether it's a legit connection. And then you as the end app, you'll use someone else, sometimes Stripe or sometimes another like banking partner to actually move the money around. We're really about the free exchange of the data, like on behalf of the consumer, right? The consumer allows us on their behalf to share data, because all finances, like at the end of the day, right? Finance is only one thing, it's risk. And to understand risk, you need to understand two things about people. You need to understand their ability to take on a risk and their willingness to pay for it over time. And the best predictor of that is your earning and spending pattern, right? You look at people's history of, have they paid loans in the past? How much do they earn? Like, how do they earn? And that's how you decide whether someone's eligible for a loan or whether you can make an instant bank payment. So we look at it as a data problem, right? Like, this concept of making your financial identity move around. Like, if we allow for that to happen, then people can create great experiences on top of it.
And do you build a financial ID yourself, or do you rather integrate with all the APIs of all the different or the non-existing APIs of all the banks that you work with?
Yeah, we don't repackage it into like one identification. Like we haven't created one singular authentication and identification layer on top of it. We actually rely on the authentication and identification layer of the banks beneath. So the way it works is, say you're an American and you have two credit cards and two main bank accounts, right? Like this is a pretty common story in the United States, and these might be at different financial institutions. If you want to connect to an app, you'll have to select all four institutions. You'll have to log into each one of them, and then that app will have access to that data. And if you decide that the app doesn't need all four banks, right, that's your choice. There isn't an authentication layer on top of that. Although I think if you look long term, that would be wonderful to have. But you know, there's a lot of security that's kind of baked in by the banks with things like app to app too. Now, you know, in the flow, you might just, you know, we're getting to a place where when you select the bank, it kicks you off into the bank's app. You just do like Face ID. It goes back. It's almost, you know, painless to connect. The banks have already done a lot of the work of verifying people's identifications, make sure it's a real human being and so on and so forth. And so we really re-leverage a lot of that. And then the second part of your question was like, oh, yeah, there's like 10,000 banks. Do you integrate with all their APIs? Well, I mean, the reality is some banks have APIs. And we wish and we want all banks to have APIs because that's the easiest way to integrate and the best way. And that's how you get the best data quality. But, you know, again, there's this long history of financial market innovation in the United States. And what it's resulted in is, you know, 9,000-10,000 financial institutions. A lot of Americans are served by community banks, small banks that might only have four or five branches. They're very local to their community, right? That understand the businesses locally so they can, they're better at issuing business loans, right? And so on and so forth. And so those small banks are generally built on top of third-party platforms, but they may not have APIs, although increasingly they do. And so, in the early days of Plaid, like, you know, we might have to look at like the hidden APIs that they have to be able to integrate and so on and so forth. But it was really important for us from a mission perspective to cover, you know, most Americans. I mean, it's the market, right? There's this weird feeling where if you just do it for the big banks, then you're kind of advantaging the coasts of the country, right? And for us, I think we just want a service that provides value to everybody. And that was a differentiator. Like one of the reasons I think Plaid won, one of the things we did really well is have very, very broad coverage of the American consumers. By the way, now we're not just in the US, we're talking and I know you're in Germany. We're in Canada as well. We launched in Europe a year and a half ago. Now in Europe, Plaid uses open banking, right? We're just a provider on top of open banking. And even though in Europe there aren't as many banks, it's the same problem for developers. They don't want to integrate with all the different open banking APIs and standards. It's too complicated. They just want one company to take care of it for them. So even without, you know, the diffused nature, there's a space for someone like Plaid to just make it much easier for fintech kind of innovation to happen.
I think in Germany, there's a company called Solaris Bank. I don't know if you know them. They are also, I think they are a bank on their own, but they also try to deliver high quality APIs to developers, right?
Yeah, that pattern, there's a few other companies like that that have a first party solution. And then to build the first party solution, they had to build the integrations, and now they're turning around and providing a service like Plaid with the integrations. Yeah, definitely. Europe definitely has, each market actually has a few competitors already to us. It's interesting. I like competition. I think it pushes the team. The engineers at Plaid that are working on Europe feel more competition, I would say, than the ones in the US. And in a good and healthy way, they're pushing our product forward and making it better. Because you have to, right, to win.
Do you also support brokerage?
Yeah, we do in the US. We support brokerage accounts. So, all your positions and so on and so forth. That's like, it's even more complicated. Like the variety of data is more complicated. So
I can imagine that. So I'm a customer of Interactive Brokers, which is a broker from the UK. And I think they have quite good APIs in comparison to others. And from my perspective, the APIs are shitty. So I can imagine that it's really horrible.
Brokerage is really tough. There's a weird thing in the investing world that I didn't know about until I joined Plaid, but there's no unique identifier for a financial instrument. Like for a stock, sure, it's easy, but you know, there's lots of like different options and so on. Some of them, it's like there's like four different standards of what the unique identifier should be. And so when you're looking at positions across different institutions, and what we try to do is normalize the data into like one canonical view to make the developer's life easier. That's a hard problem. We have this whole system that tries to identify like a real true universal identifier for a particular, you know, stock or option or contract.
So you are a professional in ID mapping.
I am not, but I have people on the team who are professional mappers. Yeah.
So maybe stepping a little bit back to your personal life. I was just hearing like a child crying in the background. So you have a kid?
I do. I have a year, 1.5 year old. Yeah. I have a son. Called Theo, named Theo. He's not quite in the background, but I've closed the door to my office, which I think is a signal to him that he needs to go and try to get in or make noises outside to get me to come out. But he's wonderful. I enjoy being a father. Do you have any kids?
Yeah, I have a 3-year-old daughter. I'm asking because I like the comparison between work life and like growing children, and also seeing how kids actually learn, and then you look at, let's say AI, and you realize how much more complex and brilliant the human system is still, right?
Yeah, being a parent is humbling. He learns much faster than I do. To think that once I learned that quickly is funny trip down memory lane. I don't know a ton about AI. Like just it's not an area of CS that I've spent a bunch of time in, but just looking at them, like stand up and manage balance on this tippy toes and everything. And I think we're far. We are very far. That's the way that feels to me.
And yeah, you can also learn a lot about management in the early days, right?
You learn about your mistakes in management. Yeah. I mean, they push your buttons, right? I refer to my son sometimes as like his purpose in life is to get an emotional rise out of me. It doesn't matter if the emotion is a positive one or a negative one, right? He's very much reacting to my emotions. And so even, you know, you betray emotions in everything that you do. And so he's picking up on the smallest variance on that. And it's the same thing, right? If you're on a one-on-one with someone as a manager, you realize pretty quickly, like if you're having a down day, right, you're going to give every one-on-one, you're going to give that down vibe to everybody that you have. Or if you're not very careful about how you phrase some things, you could offend somebody, right? It could be about you and not about them, which is not what you want. It's the same thing with a child, but I think they're like constantly picking up things and they don't have any frame of reference. They don't, right? They're building their frame of reference. So early on, every mistake, quote, parenting mistake that you make, right? Every time you overreact to something, gets amplified a ton. Like the funniest example for my son right now is he refuses to give me a high five. He used to love giving me high fives, right? He would go on the swing and every time he came up, he would give me a high five, put my hand up and get a high five and I would laugh. What happened, this is my interpretation is, I think one time he came up for a high five and our hands missed and I made a big deal out of it. And then after that, he started removing his hand at the top of the high five. And I was like, oh my God, you won't give me a high five? But because I was expressing more from not giving the high five than I was when our hands actually hit, I think he's actually internalized that it's funny to not give the high five, which is like a really focused, it's like really broken system because he just couldn't tell the difference between like fake disappointed me and excited me. And that's, you know, that's the end. So right now he refuses to give us high fives. That's life, you know. It's a little
Let's see
mistake.
How it evolves.
Yeah,
let's see how it evolves. I mean, it really gets amazing when like the more interactive parts with understanding each other start. That's really impressive how it's working out and how, like as you said, a little human with no knowledge can evolve so quickly. It's really really amazing. So
I mean, at 3 years old, right, you're like in the middle of like complex sentences and like constant association between concepts. So I assume it's all about that right now for you.
It is totally. It's crazy. But talking a bit more about yourself. So you said that you initially studied law. How did you become a geek at all?
I mean, I think of myself as quite geeky and nerdy historically, although society, I think, has kind of over time beat it out of me and made me a little bit more conformist. The origin, I think it's my dad. My dad was, he was like the first person to have a VCR, like in our town. You know what I mean? Like he'd heard about the VCR in America. He'd gone to the local hi-fi store, asked them when they were getting them, which is like a year later, you know, kept bothering them every like month until he knew that they had an order coming in, then got a VCR, which he then promptly used to record every sports program in the history of personkind. And so he was always like, I don't know, on the edge of technology. You know, I don't know if this means anything to listeners now, but it literally used to be like, we lived in Switzerland, right? Like Switzerland wouldn't get the tech first. Like the tech would be in France or it would be in America, right? You had to wait to get it. And so one of the things that my dad did when I was quite young is he got me a Commodore. I don't remember. I know I had it when I was seven. So I think it was more like when I was 6 years old that he must have gotten it. And Commodore, for those who aren't here, it's an old computer from the 1980s. The Commodore 64 was like one of these computers that went really, really mainstream. The programming language on it was BASIC. But really you played a lot of games on it, right? As a child. So I had this Commodore and I played a lot of games, but my dad was like, listen, you can't just play games on it. This isn't just a thing for gaming. So he found like one of the older kids. I played a lot of soccer. One of the older kids that in the soccer team that I was in, like, you know, like a 14-year-old, whereas I was like, you know, at the time I must have been like seven now, to come over like once a week and teach me how to code because he knew how to code. Now, teaching me how to code basically meant copy and pasting basic commands to like make the screen blink or to do things like that. But just that experience kind of got me into the computer. And then when I was in high school, I used to play something like text-based massive multiplayer games. They were called MUDs. They're like text-based, you know, World of Warcraft games. Like you walk into a room, there's an orc, then you type attack orc or hit orc or whatever. And it would tell you, you know, you missed or you hit him for 38 damage or whatnot. So I used to go online. I used to dial for my computer as a teenager when I was like a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, to these BBSs to play these games. And I kind of got addicted to them. But the problem is I had school, right? And school took a lot of my time. And so what I started doing is I started writing programs that would play these games for me, which is pretty easy because they could you just walk from room to room and you kill orcs and you'd get experience and you'd pick up the gold. And so then when I came home from school at 4 p.m., I would have like leveled up or whatnot. And then it got pretty into it. Like some things were too difficult for me to kill alone. So I wrote a program that I gave to my friends that they ran on their computers while they were at school. And our characters would use the chat functionality to communicate and decide what to do. There's no AI. It was very, very basic. Like we all moved in the same direction and did the same things. But like when one's health was low, the other one cast a healing spell on it and so on. And then the owners of the BBSs got mad at us because we were hoarding their phone lines. Because the way you dialed in was actually with a phone modem. So you were hoarding a line for it. And so we did things like we logged off and on. We'd go to different BBSs to log into the same multi-user dungeon because the multi-user dungeons weren't actually on the BBSs at that point. Now they were kind of on the proto internet. So, I kind of went deep in that. And that was honestly, that was my high school years. I didn't have many, I had good friends that were all like nerdy friends, but I was very much into this kind of online games, BBSs, online communities. Sadly enough, there's still some of messages from like really embarrassing messages, like asking about Japanese anime, which I guess is cool now, but really wasn't when I was a teenager, like on online forum, like on Usenet that I wrote using my pseudonym, all that stuff. So I was
relatively nerdy, I would say. And you had huge phone bills, I guess.
So in America, dialing locally is flat rate. So all the BBSs I dialed in were fine. I did at one point trade illegal wares, right? So this is where you would upload and download games that were like part of this illegal like trading scene. I don't know if I can admit this on the internet. I don't think anyone will care. And so then I did for a while like dial in remote. And then obviously my mom, after like 30 days of this, walks into my room with like $150 phone bill, right? And just got so mad at me and grounded me and stopped me from using my computer for a couple of months. So no, but it was mostly local. And you can imagine, right? When I went to college in 1996, I went to a university called Columbia in New York City, where there was internet, like no dial-in or anything. And it was like mind exploding. And so I went to college, and you know, my probably would have been a history major, economics major, or who knows, like something else. And I just went to CS class and spent all of my time in the CS lab. So it was pretty nerdy or dorky, but I just never asked myself what I wanted to do, you know, until I was in my mid-20s. It was just computers were it.
Yeah. I have a similar history, I would say. And then you work for Dropbox, and now you do banking, which is like quite a change. And maybe coming a bit more to Plaid, if you look at your tech stack, so is there anything impressive in it you would say that's really our secret sauce? I guess you're pretty good in integrating with legacy APIs then, right?
Yeah. We do have some secret sauce. I think, okay, if you look at Plaid, there's two things. Well, we do have many things well, but there's like two things externally that you can kind of tell we do really well. The first thing is integrate with banks. And that part of the stack is very pragmatic, but it's just about having really easy tools to integrate with an API, right? So if you integrate with an API, you get data back, you've got to parse it, right? You've got to clean it. And so we've just made the job of doing that really, really fast so that we can do it over and over again. So when a bank changes their API and tells us after they've done it, meaning they don't give us any forewarning, someone can go in there in just a few hours, like rewrite an integration with a bank to a new API spec, like very, very quickly. The tools there, you know, it's like document parsers, right? It's like PDF parsers. It's like additions on top of an HTTP library.
So all that stuff. Web scraping a lot.
Yes, right? Like a lot of web scraping stuff. There's some cleverness. There's like, you know, we have a thing that looks like a browser that has like added functionality. That's like a virtual browser that we do that we've kind of customized. There's a bunch of stuff that we've done that's really clever. I can't talk too much detail about the tools because that's like, I think, talking about like the secrets of what makes us successful. But we've invested a lot of that. And we have teams whose job is just to make the tools better. So really proud of that part of the work. All that stuff is actually written in TypeScript, right? Because I think originally it was a lot of web scraping. I think now it's much more APIs, but we've evolved, you know, we evolved it. Like if you're going to just parse web pages, right? Like web pages are powered by HTML and JavaScript, might as well, you know, be working in Node and working with them in JavaScript. So that's that part of the stack. After that, we actually use Go for most of our data pipeline. So once we've gotten the data before we share it, I mentioned we like normalize it, we clean it, we make it easier for developers to use. That whole pipeline is Go. Why Go? You know, Go is not the like world's most exciting language, right? That it's not like, it's not Rust or Zip or something. But it's a great team language because there aren't 1,000 ways to do the same thing. And when you have a team of hundreds of engineers, where about 200 engineers are now working together, you want like a common mental framework to kind of be enforced. What's nice about Go is because there aren't 1,000 ways to do the same thing, people tend to like fall back on the same abstractions. That data pipeline is pretty microservices heavy. I don't know if it's microservices, but you know, we run somewhere like, I don't know, 50 to 75, maybe 50 to 100 services across Plaid. It's just a well-designed pipeline. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing extraordinary about it. You get dirty data on one end, you get normalized data on the other. And then the second thing that we do really well is API design, I think. You know, if you're building for developers, like you want to remove the friction for a developer to get started and get what they want out of your product. And so I think there it's not about engineering in terms of scalability or what language you use. I think it's just about taste. And it's about caring about API design. You know, and you can, the different choices you can make, but I think you got to be critical and look at your API every once in a while and say like, hey, it's accumulated a decent amount of debt. Like, how do we change some of the core abstractions that we've built around? And I think we do that pretty well. I'm proud of the team. I'm proud of our docs. I'm proud of our how we do developer relations. I think that side of the house is really well run.
Yeah, I think it sometimes still sounds strange to me, but really delivering high quality APIs and especially high quality API documentations is one of the most important things to me these days if I look at a new product. So looking at, I mean, companies like Stripe started with it, I think. I don't know if you know Airtable, for example.
Yeah.
They have crazy good APIs and it's really fun to use. And it's brilliant if you can just jump into an API and understand it straight away and try out things, having interactive documentation. It's good.
Yeah. There's a friend of mine is working on this thing called, it's called like Darklang. It's like kind of a proprietary language that allows you to build integrations really, really quickly. And so you were talking about like Airtable. Like I think it's crazy to me now how quickly you can in like 15 minutes, like write an app that gets some data from A, does interesting stuff to it, puts it in B, and then B is like Airtable. So then you can go in Airtable and you can do more stuff with it. And then you can get it back out and put it somewhere else. And it takes like no time. And so if you're programming fluent, just the amount of quote unquote free stuff, like cool processing that other people have built that you can access through APIs is magical. The thing about API design and doc design, which is interesting to me, is that I think like engineers are really hard on other engineers, like really, really hard. So even sometimes APIs that are really easy to use, like people will complain about them or people complain about the docs and say they sound like too corporate, right? Like they're not engineering enough. I think as a group of folks, we could sometimes be a little less hard on our peers about it. But yeah, the API ecosystem is incredible. I think we're only scratching the surface. Like you mentioned, you know, the company that was a banking company, right? Like the Plaid competitor in Germany, they've solved a lot of problems and they were like, wait, hold on. Like we can make those problems available to others. That idea is so powerful that now once we've solved a problem once as a society, just once, if the people who've solved it once, and it's a data problem, it's a problem that involves zero and one, they can just make their solution available to the world. Like the solution itself isn't just a competitive advantage for their business. They could just allow other people to leverage it and pay for it. Just that idea, I think, will keep finding magic in it for a really long time. It's beautiful.
Like all those open standards out there, you mentioned open banking. I don't know who drives it, but yeah, it's just there and it's working. I think like the API first world is just getting started, right?
I mean, that's my opinion around it for sure. But APIs aren't, right? APIs are part of the... So it's funny because you just touched on standards. I think this podcast, I don't know if it's going the direction you want to anymore, but I don't care. The idea behind APIs and standards are like really interesting because one thing about APIs is that different companies that do the same thing have APIs that are not compatible, right? They're not the same, right? And so you have to like do all this glue all the time. And that's from an innovations perspective. It's good when you have a new solution. You kind of want the market to determine like what's the right thing. But then at the end of the game, you kind of do want standards, right? You kind of do want like a known way to interact. And so like an example is like identity, right? There's no standard around identity, right? And so like there's like 17,000 ways that people wrap identity in the world. And it kind of sucks, right? Because what company gets started is like, I have to do identity again. I have to figure out like credentials and how I determine that it's the right person. So I'm going to do two-factor auth with their phone number or with their email. It's like, you know, and so I think the API solutions will take us a long way, but I think we need more building blocks, like some more core building block. Payments is another area, right? And I think Stripe's great. Like Stripe's built awesome conceptual building blocks around payments, right? So they have like a building block that works for instantaneous payments, but payments that don't settle immediately, they've built like an abstraction around that, right? They have like the abstraction works for first party or for third party. They built all these and it's wonderful. It's like awesome. It's like it's a great API. It's a great set of abstractions, right? But like Adyen has their own, right? And like you can go down the list, like Alipay has their own, but really all these people, everyone we're just trying to do is like make it easy for somebody to move money around, right? And I think we've learned enough probably that someone could step back and say like, yo, everyone, like I think we can agree for 80%, this is the right shape. This is the way you think about it. We'll still let innovation happen everywhere else, but we've agreed on that. And it's not where, and none of the companies, by the way, are incentivized to do this because you want to capture value by keeping people in your ecosystem, right? And so this is where the interface between standards and APIs is interesting, is that at some point for some things, you maybe don't want the companies to capture as much value. And that's where government and regulation, I think, has to be smart about these things. It just takes time. And I don't personally have a ton of trust yet in like standards making the right decision over and over again, but I think we will get better at it as a species.
Yeah, but I think it automatically happens like 10 years after came up with something, and then there's something new like DeFi and blockchain. What is your perspective on that? I guess that could be something you see critically as someone working with a lot of older APIs. Is it a reinvention of your space or is it not?
I don't know. We look at it. I find it, I would say, fascinating. And I am sure, I'm sure that it will create further disruption. It still feels like the Wild West. Like it still feels so far from the average person. I don't have many radical thoughts. My thought would be that I think DeFi will change, will allow people to have better financial services. I am not sure it will change who the brokers are of the financial services. So if I look at really successful like lending fintech, I think as DeFi takes off, they can start offering that as a way to back like lending that they do for end customers. Like I think the big jump was people being willing to bank from their phones and not going to the branch anymore. Like I think that was the big jump. Like, you know, in the US, there's this trading app called Robinhood, right? That's very popular. Or you have these wallets like Venmo and Square Cash. Like, I think all these companies are looking at DeFi. And I think as they see opportunity to leverage that technology to offer like cheaper loans or different financial products that are contractually guaranteed, like they'll be able to. The blockchain is advantageous as, I think, kind of a back-end technology, I feel like, more so than a consumer-facing technology in its current incarnation. It's like kind of too complicated for the normal person. So you still need this intermediary. And the intermediary is the current, like the fintech, the current winners of the wave, I think will be able to leverage DeFi. That's the way I look at it now. I could be totally wrong. Like it might upend things so much that the intermediary's value becomes lower. But I don't know. I'm not there yet. You know, it's the thing, like I have a lot of friends that have crypto. So I have my hardcore crypto friends that have like these physical wallets and everything. Yeah. And then I just know a bunch of people who are on Coinbase, right? But now everyone, right? It's like when Coinbase took off, these other companies started offering you functionality to like buy and sell Bitcoin. Like that wasn't a huge jump, right? Sure, Coinbase got very big and they did it well. But like over time, more people are doing it. So that's kind of the way I view DeFi. I'm not sure if there'll be a couple of DeFi winners, but I just think we'll see those kinds of contracts in other products.
This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, the New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist.
From an ecosystem, it's kind of impressive what Ethereum, for example, is representing. And the way you can actually formulate smart contracts and what you can theoretically build on it. The last time I took a look at it, it was put like mostly used for gambling purposes because like you had to have that nerdy Web3 extension in your browser and all of that. Yeah, but still, I think one shouldn't underestimate it. I think at a certain time it will be there. I would not say that it then renders your company irrelevant. That's absolutely not the case. I think it will be like a very useful tool for us at a certain time. I always compare it a bit. It's a bit stupid, but I compare it to mobile when it first came on, right? When first people were telling me that the web will be mobile. I was just irritated. It was so strange using those old phones with the old browsers and everything.
It looks. I agree. It's in the infancy state, but things will move quickly. The use case doesn't quite feel there. It's funny because you know for us, the question is like whether we should be threatened by it, right? By as a company like Plaid that's mostly built on the traditional financial system. Like, you know, how should we think about? I always think about, you know, crypto and blockchains, Ethereum, so on and so forth. For a long time, like my observation was like, well, actually, people still need to move money from the traditional system to the new system. And that's what we're really good at enabling, right? That's a key part. And as long as some people's spending is on the traditional system, the only way you get a complete picture of somebody is by having both sides. And so, you know, I always think of my mother, you know, the mom test, which is like kind of think about like what are your parents going to use? And the reality is we're going to live in a hybrid world for a really, really long time, even if the new technologies like really take off. And so that's why I think for Plaid, like we look at it because I think long-term we want to be really compatible with it, but I don't think we view it as disruptive, right? There might be exceptions. Like I don't know, in China, right? They're doing the thing where they're trying to move all their money to a blockchain, right? Like there might be places where there's like a forced disruption in one direction. But if I look at most of Europe or the US, I see it as an evolution and not as a revolution on short time scales. If you like talk to humans 100 years from now and you told me like, oh, 100 years from now, all financial everything will be powered by like blockchains and smart contracts, I'd be like, yeah, that makes total sense. But, you know, if you told me in like 10 years, I'd be like, oh, I don't know about that. I'm not a predictor of the future.
I agree. Me neither. I mean, sometimes strange things happen like COVID. I guess that it's also like a huge kick to bank branches potentially dying and your business also exploding, right?
Yeah, I think it's no secret that it's been a really good year for fintech. There's like these stats. We did a survey late last year, which I think was pretty interesting, just about from average consumers, a little bit about how they thought about financial services. So it's insane. Like 80% of people said, at the end of COVID, well, at the end, like last fall, that they could manage their money without going to a bank branch. And that was like a new thing in COVID, right? They could now manage their money without going to a bank branch. 73% of people said that like fintech for them is the new normal in terms of how they interface with their financial lives. That was not true a year before, right? I mean, people were forced to just do things from their phones. The branches were closed. They just couldn't do it. And so, yeah, in that sense, it's a re-envisioning. I think it collectively helps people think about how a lot of the financial services they rely on don't actually need meeting a person in a building, right? Or how, you know, they don't need a cash nearly as much as they thought they did, right? Some of it is fintech. Some of it's not fintech, right? Some of it is people just ordering food online and getting it delivered. And so things that they used to pay for in cash in a store is now, or with a credit card, is like on a wallet by this app, because the delivery company is the cash, right? kind of situation. So all these things are happening. And I think at the end of the day, there will be fewer branches when things reopen up. There will still be things where you want to talk to a person and see them face to face. And, you know, I think of like business lending and like more, but yeah, some of it's gone away and it accelerated things, trends that were happening. I think it was all going to happen and maybe it would have happened over 4 or 5 years. And we got it in 9 months, and now we're kind of scrambling to adapt.
I remember that we had a conversation about how you see privacy and also engineering in the privacy space. And I find this kind of interesting because I come from the edtech world and used to work in the edtech world. And there, it was always something missing. So I always saw like billions of events flowing through. And I was always thinking about like a remember to delete me reminder and all those events. How do you think about that? And what do you think about privacy engineering when you come up with a term?
Yeah. The first analogy I kind of like to make is that is to building bridges. For a long time, humans build bridges, right? And sometimes the bridges would crash and we were like, oh, that's bad. And so we're like, well, we should have professionals who know how to build bridges, right? And this exists for a long time, right? It existed in the Middle Ages and Roman times and so on and so forth, right? We didn't let too many bridges get destroyed before we figured we need people who knew a little bit more about them. The 21st century equivalent, right, story of building bridges is you have like civil engineers, right? And their job is to make sure that like the bridge is safe, right? And they have professional practices and standards. And you sometimes don't even hire one civil engineering firm. You hire two. You hire one to like put together the plans for the bridge with the architect. And then you hire another to make sure that all the numbers line up and that the bridge is not going to have some weird conditions. So we've built like thousands of years of knowledge about how you build bridges that last, right? And this knowledge is encoded through this discipline that exists. If I look at privacy engineering with data, that does not exist. It just doesn't exist. We're like at the beginning stages, like the early stages of figuring out what privacy means. And I think that's what makes it fascinating. Like, and so you talked about ad tech. So in the US, there's a lot of tech companies that are funded by ads, right? So a really interesting company is Snapchat, because Snapchat has, on the ad privacy side, actually like quite forward-leaning practices. And why is that? Because they saw it as a potential differentiator for the business relative to some of the old school companies were. Old school, it's such a funny word for companies that were born in like 1998. But right, so some of the big established online social or other platforms, not to name names. And so there's actually like people that they recruited at Snapchat who just, I think, had thought a lot about privacy and ad tech from their previous jobs. They went to Snapchat and the mission was like, hey, like more privacy forward. And they thought about what that meant for ads, how you could still have a great ad business and think about privacy differently, right? And that's great, but it's still like we're still in the early stages. So, you know, for me, like for financial services, there's like these high level concepts that matter a ton. I think if you're going to do anything with data, and I think some of it's influenced by GDPR and CCPA. CCPA is the California privacy law. GDPR is the European one. But I think GDPR and CCPA aren't privacy. They're like partial solutions to what privacy should mean. Like, I think you need to step back and ask yourself, like, what are the principles that things should be based on? So I think from a consumer perspective, I think some of the principles would be like transparency, just fully knowing what is happening with your data. Like what is happening with it? It's really important. And the second one is control. And control is the ability to say no, like not just at the moment of purchase or interaction, but it's the ability to say no at any time thereafter. Okay. So that's the first. So that's like the one company view for me of privacy from a consumer perspective is like, you should ask yourself the question, like, what's the right amount of transparency? But again, I don't think it's established what right amount is, but you should ask yourself that question. And then you should ask yourself, like, what are we going to do to give control to the end user? And control is not sending an email to privacy at your company name. That's not control, right? Control is like an easy to find place where they can say delete everything or like, I don't want this thing to have access anymore, right? It's sending them like, you know, like a reminder that you have their data or whatever. You got to get those two things, right? But what's interesting when you're coming out of Plaid is like the very definition of Plaid is we help data go from bank A to bank B or from bank A to app B, right? It flows through us. So the question for me about privacy is about not just what you do, it's about the chain. It's about what does everybody do on the chain? Because privacy is only as strong, right, as the weakest link in the chain, right? If you're like an ad tech, right, ad tech companies are like sharing data and there's someone in the middle of that chain that decides to like willy-nilly share the data with anybody who wants it for like a dollar, then you're like, you got no privacy. That's the situation that you're in. So I think for me, the important thing is, okay, so you've got transparency, you've got control, but you got to have some way to make sure the privacy lives in the entire ecosystem. And for us, it's our terms of service with the developers that build on top of Plaid. You got to limit what they can do with the data, right? You have to, like, that's the way. the thing that I really want to get to eventually, though, is a place where the transparency and the control can also be imposed at any point in the chain. Meaning, like, if you want your data to stop appearing, you don't just go to one place and then another place and then the third place and the fourth place and the fifth place and the sixth place and you're like, limit, 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 or delete, 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 delete. You actually can go to any point in the chain, the place, anyone that you have a relationship, and you should be able to say, like, remove it. And it gets removed from everywhere. That's like kind of when I think personally, like, that's like kind of, you know, taking control and transparency plus the concept of the chain together, like, that's what gets the best outcome. So hold on. This is the first part of my answer on privacy engineering. The second part of the answer, which I think is the more interesting one and the one that's about internal, about best practices that I don't have a good answer for, but privacy is going to be about what you do internally at your company, your data practices from day one. It's like right now, a lot of companies operate in a world that would say, like, default internally is not privacy. It's like, use the data to do stuff. And then when they want to release a product, they have a discussion with, like, lawyers internally and so on. Hey, can we release the project, like, the product or whatever, right? What you really want is, like, the default to be full privacy or, you know, whatever your definition of privacy is internally. And you want all your systems to enforce it so that then when you launch something, it's more like you need an exception to be able to launch something that doesn't fall into your default posture. And there's actually, I think there's like an initial discussion right now happening right now about this because of some privacy stuff that, like, Facebook has announced. You don't generally think about Facebook as the most privacy forward company, but internally at Facebook, I think there's a lot of people that want Facebook to be a lot more, like, privacy conscious. So there's some subdivisions of Facebook that are talking about it. So you can look that up online and it's interesting. But the reality is, like, for the internal practices, we're still a little bit in the dark ages. Let's compare it to security, right? For security now, like, there are best practices. It's like, yeah, you don't let a random engineer start a new service. Or if you do, like, you give them a Terraform version of the service at first that's, like, not readable from the internet, right? That has all these limits on it because you don't want to get hacked, right? And you know that. And so there's this whole discipline, security engineering, that's focused on it. Privacy engineering that's starting to exist, but it doesn't happen at the beginning of a company, right? People are starting to think about security from day one of a company. I don't think as many people are thinking about privacy from day one. There's exceptions. Like, you know, I don't love Apple for many things. Like, I think Apple is a company that it is a competitive advantage for them. And I think they live that stuff, right? And it's privacy by default. And they feel like the burden is on them internally and externally to, like, make an exception to their privacy practices. And it's so powerful for them, but it took, like, a decade to build up, right? And now that consumers care, wow, what an unassailable position, right? Like, because if you're one of the other companies that weren't privacy forward, good luck becoming Apple. There's nothing you can do in 12 months. There's nothing you can do in 24 months. There's nothing you can do in 36 months. There's nothing you can do in 48 months to get there. It is like, that is a, it's a long path to get there. So that's my opinion on it. I think right now, I think we're getting to a place where the consumer view is starting to get defined more and more well, but I still think we're lacking the internal best practices and people are working on it, right? Like, I think a lot of people are thinking about this. So I think it's exciting. It's exciting in the end game. It'll be good for consumers. I think it'll be good for innovation to have clarity over time. But in the meantime, it's a lot of questions and it's a lot of churn and it's going to be some bad news.
Yeah, honestly, I like the idea. I think it's brilliant. I mean, just remembering wherever you used your Facebook Connect button, for example, whenever you want to be deleted on Facebook, Facebook would have to talk to all these companies where you used your Facebook Connect button theoretically and ask them to delete your data, which is, I think, right now just conceptually not there, right?
Blockchain. Well, you know, you talk about a place, right? There's interesting, like, cloudlets is another interesting thing. A cloudlet is like where all your data lives in a little box that you own and people can't quite get it fully out, but they can do some processing on it, but you own the box. At the end of the day though, right? If the raw data gets out, you've got to trust that other party. And so I think it'll come down to legal something, 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 right? Regulators have a positive space. Anyway, sorry.
I'm a bit worried that it will take a while. So, I mean, if you just look at browsers, how browsers evolve, browsers are becoming slowly like a small app store where you always have to select the identity you would want to provide to the website, and then at a certain moment, Google will start selling that data to the website and so on. So I think the time of gatekeepers that earn money with your data is not over, unfortunately. But
I think the question is, like, say I go get a loan somewhere, and they told me, like, hey, I'm going to use your spending history to build a lending model that allow me to offer cheap loans to other people, but I'm not selling your data. Like, you're okay with that. I think you're okay with someone using your data for some things. You're not for others, right? And you just don't know right now. That's the thing that's, like, most worrisome. But I think it'll take a while. I think it's a real challenge. Look, you talk about the browser, right? Like, what's the incentive for things in life? You always think about what is the incentive, right? The incentive is to make money. And there's a lot of money to be made in data. And that's why money is being made, right? And that's why the browser have cookies that work the way they do and so on and so forth. It's not the only way to do things, but you're not going to innovate on that when the business model of the companies that are propping up the browsers is internally tied to that. And so you have to think about incentive. But the question then is, do you get to a point where consumers care about it enough that the incentive is in the other direction? And I think Apple tells you, like, yes.
I think Apple does that perfectly, right? Yep. I'm also a huge fan of that. Just understanding that I pay for the service and I pay, I don't know, €10 a month or $10 a month and that's it. And nobody's using that data is calming me down whenever it's around my private photos or private stuff. It's that's important for me, or became important for me in the last 10 years.
Yeah, same.
Coming to the end of nerdism and a bit more towards your career as a CTO and the fact that the life of the CTO is lifelong learning. So how do you keep up with all the stuff that is evolving and that is distracting you every day? How do you learn?
I don't do it super well. I have some weird philosophies that I don't think are true, but I believe them, you know, so works for me. Like, I'm not sure that much is happening, like, day to day, week to week, month to month, even 6 month to 6 month, that, like, fundamentally changes my job. Right? I don't think that's true. So I'm not actually that concerned with keeping up with the micro changes in things, technologically speaking. I read Hacker News, right? Like, back in the day, I used to program in Clojure a lot, so I kind of follow what's happening in that community. But I don't do those things. Like, I don't view that as part of my job. The way I learn about what's important for my job in tech actually is to talk to other CTOs and VPs of engineering about, and generally of companies that are a little more mature than Plaid or the same size, about what they're doing, what technologies they're using and what problems they're solving, like, at a high level. I have found that to be, like, a really good way to get info. The other way is I interview a lot of people. And so through interviews, I ask often questions that relate to problems I feel like we could be solving better. And I find out about how other companies are doing it. And so I think my job is to have, like, high level awareness. And I find that people are a really good conduit, because they're not telling me about the hot technology. They're telling me about what they're using at scale. And, you know, if you're a CTO, you got to think about usage at scale more than you think about hot technology. You need people on your team that are thinking about hot technology. Don't get me wrong. But, like, at the CTO level, I just don't have many. I can't think of times in my career. And granted, I have a short career, right? So I'm biased. But where it was like life and death was about quickly adopting something. Like very quickly, you know, it's like even when you think about, like, Kubernetes, it's like, did you really want to be early on the Kubernetes boat? Like, no, you didn't, because it was like a really good idea with very little implementation. Even now, it's not like it's, like, you know, been proven at scale. It has, but it's, you know, it's not like the open source stuff out there just, like, out of the block makes it better than however you were managing DevOps before. And so, like, even these transformative things, they take time. Or you look at data warehouses, right? It's like, oh, you're on Redshift, but why aren't you on Snowflake? It's like, yeah, Snowflake's, like, better for a bunch of stuff. But, like, is that business ending? Like, is that, like, the delta between success and failure as a company? Or is that the delta between having a few more data infrastructure engineers or a few less? And so, like, for me, it's like that. It's like, I just, I don't, I don't feel like I'm going to lose that. But I do talk to people, and if I hear a lot of people mention something that I don't know anything about or that I feel like we could leverage, either I will educate myself or ask someone on my team to educate themselves, and then I might go to a book or I might go to, you know, online forums. I might go to Medium post, like whatever, right? I'll identify content that's worth reading, and so yeah.
Yeah, you just found the reason why I do the podcast.
Oh, perfect. Fantastic. No, it's brilliant, right? And then I think hopefully people who are listening too, it's like there's a lot of good content out there. It's just, you know, that this weird expectation in life that, you know, sometimes you hear a TED Talk and you like the TED Talk ends and you're like, it changed my life. And you have that feeling, right? And you're like, oh, it's a new way to approach things. And then you wake up the next day and actually doesn't change anything. Like, that's the way I feel about, like, I just don't feel like there's that much that's going to fundamentally change the human experience of managing a team of people that's trying to take on hard challenges. Like, we're humans. Like, we're not changing that much, right? You can change the things around us. You can tell me to use Rome research or whatever, but it's just like, yo, it's fine, people. We were writing notes on pieces of paper for a long time before.
So, one more question for you. And instead of recommending books, I tend to ask people for amazing tools that they just discovered in the last years. And I think we spoke about Airtable. Do you have anything? So Airtable for me is a tool I annoy everyone with because I like it. It's so brilliant. Do you have anything you would recommend or you annoy your friends with?
I don't push my opinion on friends that much. All my friends are annoying me about Rome research right now. Like, you know, they're making me feel like I'm a Neanderthal for not using Rome Research. If you don't know what Rome Research is, it's a note-taking app that's like, looks like a graph. So it's not like a tree. It's like every note can be connected to any other note. And the UI is pretty neat. So they're all annoying me about that. And I refuse to believe that I will be, you know, 50% more intelligent as a human being by using it. Because I don't think anything makes you.
Is that the promise?
I don't know that. Well, the discussions that are I'm like in this Slack with, and we there was like this rant about, like, I made fun of Rome, which proved to be a mistake, and then people were trying to prove to me that how much it's changed our life. Anyway, good product. Go try it out if you want to. I don't push anything. I'm trying to think of price. Super. I use Superhuman. It's like quite expensive. It's like an email client. A lot of the features actually now are in Gmail, but I think I probably save like maybe 5 to 10 minutes a day from using it, just from shortcuts and its reminder system. And I've recommended that a few times. I'm just not a big, I hate to do this. I'm not a big tools person. How about I recommend a practice? Which I recommend all the time. Yeah. So you will not be the first podcast where I recommend this practice. But this is what I recommend. You really want to make a difference in your life. This is what you do. You take your phone and you leave it on your desk. And then you get up and you take a piece of paper and you take a pen and you go walk outside for 1 hour. And you just walk and you think about things. And then as you think about things, you write them on the piece of paper for an hour. And you do that maybe twice a week. And you come back to your desk and you do whatever you're doing before, right? You get back to it. I guarantee you, if you do that for 2 months, so it's 8 weeks, 2 hours a week, 16 hours of your life dedicated to this. And I guarantee you, on a couple of those walks, you will have a great idea about something at work, something in your personal life, just the space of not having your phone, not being in front of a screen, walking around and having the note and the pen that reminds you that you're supposed to think a little higher level and write it down. It'll be wonderful. Sometimes you go on the walk and nothing will happen, right? Because you can't force great ideas or insights. It's not possible. And as I said before, I don't really believe in big insights anyway. But it's really nice, and people just don't do it. You know, there's a reason. Like you know, you read about, you know, Mark Zuckerberg always to go on a walk, or you know, you have all these historical figures. Like, you know, they think about things at times that they don't expect, like in the shower or whatever. You create that time and it works for you. So I push that on people. Just get away from the Twitter and the buzz and let your brain relax a little bit and see what comes of it.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea. My girlfriend will love it, actually. if I try it.
does she go on walks all the time without you?
No. I think she wants me to go on walks without my mobile phone. So, I still have a little surprise for you. I just discovered an undocumented method in your transaction API called time travel. And I just built a small script that uses the API and pushes in the parameter 2007. And we now give it a shot in my shell. And we now see yourself working as associate after you studied law at a small law agency, I think. And we now observe you for a little bit and you have the chance to whisper something into your ears. What would it be?
Can I whisper two things?
Sure.
Yeah. The first one is, and this is a piece of advice I got. It's a great piece of advice. It said, just learn to say no. And actually, it comes back to a story from when I was a lawyer, which is after I joined this firm, one of the partners asked me to take on work and I felt like I was doing too much. And so I said no to them and then never spoke to me again when I was at the firm. But because there's this expectation at the law firm that you kind of work as hard as you have to get all the things done. And so you may think this was a bad professional experience, like as in for me, it was like career ending or whatever. And it wasn't good to have a partner not want to talk to me, but it actually taught me a lot about that person and how petty they were. And I think the kind of person who, when you say no, you can't do something, who respects you for saying that and for understanding what you can do well and what you can no longer do well, that's like the person you kind of want to work for. So I would say, like, just learn to say no and see how the other person reacts, right? Not just no arbitrarily, right? But because you have a good reason for it. I think it'll tell you a lot about the other human being and like their empathy level and whether it's someone that you want to work with. So I wish I'd said no earlier, like in my life always. I think you learn something through it. The second thing in life, you know, people always say, like, you know, you want to do a job that you love. Like, that's a luxury. Not everybody gets to do a job that they love, right? It's like a nice idea. My version of it is like, you should do a job where you look at the person who's doing the job 5 or 10 years later and you find it okay to be that person. But if you don't find it okay to be that person, the person that's been successful in the job and that has the career 5 or 10 years later, like, I'm not saying you love that thing. I'm saying like, you don't find it okay to be that person. Then you should be careful if you have any options, because you're just about to acclimate yourself to a version of your future self you don't want to be. And it's hard over time to do that, because if you do that, there will be other people who want to be that person and it'll just be easier for them. Now, I'm not saying you have to be a careerist and want to be the best. That's not the point, right? It's just like, if the version of your future self that you see by looking at that other human being doesn't align with your value system or other things, you probably want to change that. Don't rage quit, but like, you know, you might want to find a slightly different path or accept you're going to change as a person, which is fine too. So I think if I'd done that when I was really early as being a lawyer, or even when I was in law school, I think I would just realize that apart from like the prestige and the money and all the things that are nice about being a lawyer, I just didn't see myself doing the kind of things that the partners did. I respect them a ton, right? It's not like an ethics thing. So I think lawyers are bad. No, all that. I just didn't like the day-to-day work and what they had to do and deal with just didn't jive at the time with who I wanted to be. Whereas being an engineer, which is what I ended up being back to being like just a normal engineer somewhere, and just that little bit of, I don't love all of engineering, right? Like, I think a lot of it's boring actually, but it's creative. At the end of the day, you can look at what you did and it's creative. It's working with people. It's arguing and trying to find solutions to things in a collaborative way. Like, those two things, just like creativity and the collaboration with people, for me were magical in a way that happened as a lawyer, but like rarely, and happened as an engineer, I think often daily, you know, even if all you're just time, yeah, making strings into strings. Yeah, it's still hard enough that people pay you a decent amount for it. So I like that creativity and I like the collaboration. So that's it. That's the time machine.
Great, great closing words.
Oh, and invest in Bitcoin. Invest in Bitcoin.
Invest in Bitcoin. Okay, that's a very nice idea. So let's try to use that API then once. Okay. So Jean-Denis, thanks a lot for your time and hope to speak to you soon.
Yeah, Toby, this was great. Thanks so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and the About You Cloud. If you want to know more about Fastly services, simply visit fastly.com/alphalist. If you want to get in touch with About You and hear more about the About You Cloud, simply write to hello@aboutyou.com. Thanks a lot.